Hey, everybody. My name is Damara West, and I'm founder of Be Well, Beautiful Woman, where we help women to center their healing and their liberation and their joy so that they can have abundant lives that is rooted in their authentic identities that they get to decide for themselves. I'm so delighted to be bringing you a podcast episode with the amazing, yes, the amazing Christina Steen Lyles, which leads Donor Choose efforts to incorporate a race equity forward lens in supporting students and teachers across the country. Steen led the creation of I See Me, hashtag, a Donors Choose initiative, ensuring that students see themselves reflected in their teachers and in their learning environments. Steen collaborates with companies and foundations committed to racial equity in public schools and is also passionate about growing relationships with philanthropists of color, hoping to make an impact for students and teachers. Steen graduated from Spelman College and Georgetown Law and loves all things related to cheerleading, dance, Atlanta, and coffee. She's the proud mama of two little humans and a pup. Steen, so happy to have you.
I want to bring you everywhere. I was like, I know all of this, but as I hear it, I'm like, oh my goodness, that's right. Thank you so much. And my little pup is under my feet, so hopefully he will remain nice and quiet. But
oh, no worry. No, we love pups at Be Well, Beautiful Woman. I actually have a brindle pit, so no worries. We will roll with it. Great. So, Steen, I'm just so delighted to have you on the podcast. And, you know, we're just going to dive right in because I know that you have a lot to say about philanthropy and particularly the way in which it shows up in the lives of Black and Brown people and also women. So the very first question that I want to dive into is just talk to us a little bit about Donors Choose for those folks out there that don't know anything about it and why the hashtag I See Me initiative is so very important.
Of course. Okay, first of all, thank you for having me and thank you for what you've created in this space. This is important. Like, this is a really important space. And I know from I've listened and I know so much about you and your work. And so I know we'll talk more about like wellness and it just like the space this creates, but let me just say thank you because it means a lot to me. And that really also just maps to the work that I do at Donors Choose, to be honest, because, you know, at Donors Choose, our mission is to make education more equitable, right? Right. We believe that a student's race nor their zip code should dictate whether or not they have access to the resources and the learning environments that they need. Right. And so, for the past 23 years, we have been tackling education inequity. We've been focused in on students having resources. We've been focused on the teachers themselves, so teachers of color. We've been thinking about donors across the country, supporting those requests. And for those who don't know, the way that it works is that a teacher comes to our platform. So they come to donorschoose.org. They request the resources that their students need to learn. So maybe they're requesting some books, or maybe they're requesting butterfly cocoons, or maybe they're requesting iPads. And what we do is those donors from across the country. So everyday philanthropists like me, like you, we support those classroom requests. And then Donors Choose ships them directly off to the classroom. So we're not sending the teachers dollars. We are sending those books, those iPads, those cocoons directly to the classroom. And I won't go into all of the scale and how big we are, but I will just say that we are a really massive operation in terms of more than 5 million donors have supported classrooms through our site. And that's over $1 billion in resources. So that is who we are at Donors Choose. And chances are for your listeners, if you know a teacher, it's very possible that that teacher uses Donors Choose because we are in about 86% of schools across the country. So we have a really big market share on just being in classrooms and making sure that students have what they need. But I do want to speak to I See Me because that's core to the work that we do at Donors Choose, especially because while we believe that students should have resources and that where you live and your race should not dictate having access, we also realize that there's a really important part of the narrative for which resources are in classrooms, right? We know that historically, students, often students of color don't see themselves, whether or not that's in their teacher. So having a teacher of color or having access to books where you can see yourself living joyfully, right? Not just a book where we're talking, which is important, about the history of, for me, I'm a Black woman, slavery. That's important. I need to know this. That's critical to the work. And also having access to The Bluest Eye is important. Having access to Mafaro's Beautiful Daughters is important. And so this initiative that we launched basically says there is power in students seeing themselves in their teachers and in their learning environments. And we set out to not only get those resources into classrooms, but to engage philanthropists of color to bring to life those resources and requests. So we said, while it's important for students to see themselves, it's also important for those same students and those same teachers to see themselves in their donors as well, because there is something incredible about the narrative shift that happens when you realize that you can be on both sides of the impact. So yeah. That's ITME, and it's alive even today.
Yeah, I love this. And I know that you really helped to bring that initiative to light. And, you know, I've been a consultant for many years, and I remember a time talking to early childhood professionals and giving a keynote on the very thing that you're talking about, right? And how do we really tap into literature as a reservoir to tell stories about identity that are crucial to having a positive development, right? Yes. So I love that you're doing this, and I love that you're doing it on both sides. You know, prior to us starting, one of the things that we talked about is the fact that even though I've given for many years, I didn't actually coin myself as a philanthropist until I gave that big $50,000 check to the Black Arts and Cultural Center, right? But the reality is, thank you, sis. It was a big deal. Somebody actually said, I feel like you're sending a signal, and you're sending a call to action to Black people. I said, I am. And not just to us, right? To all of us, to put our money where our mouth is, right? And yet we know that from $5 on up, we've been giving in a myriad of ways, mainly within faith entities. So we've always really been philanthropists. So this leads me to the question around, you know, why is it important for us to see ourselves as philanthropists and for us to align our values with the things that we monetarily give to, on top of course, the human capital that many of us labor in, if you will?
Yes.
Ooh. I know that's a big one, sis.
It is. Okay. Well, let me say this, which is, I'm a Black woman, I identify as Black woman. I'm like Southern raised, Black woman. And so race has always been at the forefront of my life. I'm a military brat, but I've moved around a ton and mostly just seen in my sphere, race and identity at the core, right? Like I know what it means to think about race day in and day out, even if it's seeing Confederate flags on a truck here in Atlanta. You know, I think about it day in and day out. And so when it comes to this idea of identity and representation, especially showing up in philanthropy, on the one hand, on like the personal and identity front, what you're sharing is so true, that this is in many ways core to our identity as people. It's in our roots. I think about this like passing the collection plate mentality. I grew up in the Black church. So like this idea of passing the collection plate and hearing that part of the dollars are going to go to rebuild the church, the other part's going to the community. And you don't question, you just know, of course I'm going to get it. And so even if you don't have it, you have it, right? And so this idea of representation mattering in philanthropy is also something that we think a lot about at Donors Choose. I mentioned it in the conversation about I See Me, because, you know, this narrative shift is important to the work, right? I think it's easy to have a conversation about and frame giving and need to be about underprivilege or lack of access or lack of opportunity, when really there's also a conversation to be had about all of the opportunities to live into full potential. And I think for Black people, for Black women in philanthropy, who often are the communities who are left out of the conversation about who a philanthropist is, I'm beginning to see in platforms like this one, this podcast, are helping to reshift what it means for us to actually talk about engaging and really naming yourself as a philanthropist. So that was a very sermonic way of saying at Donors Choose, including through I See Me, we are really, really cultivating and engaging philanthropists of color. And for the first time at our organization, we have a team devoted to equity and thinking specifically about philanthropic diversity. And if I could just give a tiny story that maps to like the why that you're talking about here.
Please do.
Yeah. You know, when we launched ICME, it was the first time that our organization really did sort of look externally with an equity lens. So a lot of companies will have like an internal equity mindset. We'll think about the staff race or think about board of directors and representation. We turn that outward. And when we did that, it was a really interesting time for our organization. And we wanted to make sure that we had voices at the table who were going to be funding the opportunities that looks like the communities themselves. And I want to shout out two of the philanthropists who were at the table because they co-chaired the initiative. They were philanthropic co-chairs. And it was Carol Sutton Lewis, who is an incredible philanthropist in New York City. She has a podcast on ground control parenting. And then Desiree Rogers, who was in the White House, right? She was a social chair in the White House. And those two women were incredibly devoted to ensuring that they were going to chair the initiative to ensure that not only were we going to make sure that the projects got funded on donors' shoes, but they wanted to be sure that their networks of Black philanthropists, Black women, were at the table to fund them too. And so I just, when I think about what I know personally about giving both of time and of money, the people that I know who are often the most philanthropic, even if we're not using the language of being a philanthropist, are Black women. And I think about that as I go into a meeting later tonight for my Jack and Jill chapter, a group of women, Black women, supporting and engaging in community work and ensuring this happens. And so I'm forgetting what the question was. I just got so excited.
This was so good. And it makes me think like a whole campaign needs to be rolled out. Like we've always been philanthropists, right?
Right.
And so we might have to even talk offline about what that looks like. But I love this conversation. And, you know, outside of, you know, my work with Be Well, Beautiful Woman, and certainly racial healing is connected to healing, right? And I don't see those things as separate. And as a strategist in helping institutions to embed equity within their practice, some of which are working to beef up their pool of philanthropists of color or have better outcomes related to equity and inclusion. And you all have done a lot of work foundationally, and I imagine have produced really powerful outcomes as a result. So I would love for you to the extent that you want to speak to, you know, what the impact has been, and, you know, for organizations that are saying that they really want to do this, that have a similar identity to Donors Choose, what would you recommend that they do to authentically align with equity and inclusion when it comes to practice?
Well, I often, my team is so annoyed with me because I use the same narrative all the time. But when I think about my personal philosophy and therefore sort of the philosophy in my team and my work about how do you do DEI, EDI, however you want to call it, like programming really well. And so for me, I think about, you know, there was I think it was a case study. It was a while back where it's like, how do we get more Black women to come to these baseball games? Okay, let's sit around a table and let's talk about how do we get more Black women to come to the baseball game? You look around, there's no Black women around the table. Well, then how are we going to have a conversation about what to do about this community you want to reach without these people at the table? And when I think about that, I think what is so powerful about that, sort of really like sort of a, just a small example is the start, like the genesis of that question was actually the program we wanted to do. So I think a lot of companies start internally thinking we should have more people of color on staff. Well, why? Yes, there is important dynamics of diversity. The dynamics that diversity creates is known to be research backed to be really important for innovation, for profits, for nonprofits is important to think about impact. But also there's just something really incredible about creating dynamic programming and having the communities at the center of that programming at the table when it's time to do the work. And so, so much that's sort of one example. I think another sort of idea that, I think companies can take from Donors Choose in our work here is that equity and DEI work does not mean one thing. So it doesn't just mean staff. It doesn't just mean your board of directors. It doesn't just mean, in our case, the students that we serve, where we have over, I think it's 13,000 schools in our platform where the majority of students are Black. Wow. We have the largest database today of teachers of color of any organization in the country. So while we have about 600,000 teachers who have shared their demographic information with us, about 170,000 of them are teachers of color. And so 1 in 4 Black teachers in America use our platform. And that tells us that when we think about equity and someone comes to us and says, I think I want to do a program with equity, there's multifacets to the way that looks. It could be that we're talking about impact from the lens of the students in the communities, the impact of the lens of teachers. We think about it with the impact of philanthropists themselves and who they are and their identities. And so I mentioned all that just to say, I think really, I just want to put a bow on this idea of there is really a very nuanced and multidisciplinary approach that Donors Choose takes to our equity practice that in turn is meant to be community centered, but also if it's important and it's happening in public schools, it matters to us, which means we don't have the room to take a one-dimensional approach. And I know part of the work you do is around intersectionality. The same goes there. There's no one way. I don't live a one identity life.
So I love this because even though it's so simple, right, we do complicate. We oftentimes complicate this work and complicate many things, right? And, you know, I say often we can focus on the problem or we can focus on the solution. And, you know, I love that you have talked about this in such a holistic way, because as we know, what trend in the DEI, whatever we're coining the phrase to be, right? Because we know it changes and it's changed quite a bit over the years. It's still diversity as the focal point, right? And what you're offering is that these are our people and the perspectives of our people are important to shape our strategy. Mm-hmm. And if we're attempting to do anything without the voices of the people, then we are not actually tackling the problem, right? And so I love the simplicity of this, but also we know how far-fetched it is from how many institutions approach the DEI imperative or the equity imperative or whatever that might be. And the fact that you're doing it and you have all of this data, I love what you said about the fact that, you know, you have more people of color in your database. You have more students of color that are being touched by your work. And then this intentional way that you're engaging donors, and not to mention probably a plethora of other things, because what you are saying that Donors Choose has chosen to do is to adopt this in every single facet of your work. And that is different. That is different than how even to this day, many of us are approaching DEI with diversification as the number one goal, as if that equates to inclusion, as if that equates to equity.
That's exactly right. And you know, as I'm hearing you say it, I would almost say for our organization at the center of our DEI programming, EDI programming, whatever you want to call it, is equity. Because we realize there's a system that needs to be adjusted and addressed, which is how we were founded in the first place. Students living in where our founder was in the Bronx should have access to that Little House on the Prairie set of books. You don't need to have a teacher creating copies of the book in order for the students to get access. So this idea of equity is important. And I just want to underscore something else you said and give you an example of how it's looked at Donors Choose. Yeah. It's around male teachers of color, because in addition to ICME, we have launched other research-backed and data-driven initiatives. And one of them is called our Male Teacher of Color Initiative. Mm-hmm. And when we launched that survey, we essentially launched the largest ever survey centering male teachers of color, elevating specifically Black men in the teaching profession. And the whole point was to do exactly what we talked about earlier, which is center the voices of those that we want to learn from. And we know that Black men make up 2% of the teaching profession, despite having far more Black boys in public schools. And that disparity is a problem for lots of other academic concerns. But also, we need to understand, how do we get more Black men in the profession and what's keeping them there? And so to give you an example of like how listening and learning can actually inform the work, especially when the community is at the center, when we surveyed over 5,200 teachers, about 1,700 of them were male teachers of color. We learned, for example, that The group that is the most engaged in terms of spending time outside of the classroom with students were Black men. Mm-hmm. And when we then correlated different questions in the survey with, how are you, like, what are some of the factors keeping you in the classroom? And we learned that even though non-teachers of color were spending more time outside of the classroom with students, including students of color, there was not a correlation to them feeling more burnt out. And the reason that's important for sort of systemic and policy questions is for someone to take an outside approach to say, I know what's best. If Black men are spending too much time outside of classroom, we got to stop that because they're going to get burnt out. When actually it's the reverse, which is part of why I decided to become a teacher was for this very experience, which was to spend more time with my students. And that was especially so for HBCU graduates. And so all that is to say, when we stopped and we asked teachers what they needed and we learned from them, we kept those teachers at the center of the community. We then realized that we learned a lot more about our own programming and we're making more informed decisions based on that data. And the whole point was put the community at the center. So that initiative and a lot of the data is found on our website. It's called Unique Insights, Unique Burdens. It's our Male Teacher of Color initiative. And the focal point was actually Black men in the teaching profession and how we learned by listening to what they had to say.
Yeah. So this, you know, I love that we're talking about data and how you have utilized data for you all first, but then for the field, right? And so outside of just, you know, you giving substantially to educational entities and engaging philanthropists of color, you're creating resources that we can glean from in our work to have a better understanding for more localized strategies that will help to support some of the outcomes that we espouse to want. And so this was so good. So this leads me to my next question, which just has to do with philanthropy, that specifically some of the trends that you're seeing related to philanthropy regarding women, more specifically women of color, even more specifically Black women. But of course, from the perspective of those both impacted by philanthropy and then also those who are philanthropists.
Yeah, you know, I'll be really transparent in that we are in the process of figuring out how do we get more intentional in our programming at Donor's Choose here. And, you know, I hope that that is exciting to listeners to hear that a company of our size is specifically devoting resources to a team. My wonderful colleague, Noelle, is leading our philanthropic diversity strategy, which I know when we were bringing her on board, we were chuckling at like, this is a really like niche role. We're like, we need you to be thinking specifically about programs that impact communities of color and equity, but also think about the philanthropists themselves. So we do inclusive fundraising. And so I hope that if we have a follow-up conversation, we would be able to share back with you what we're learning in our work with Black women philanthropists. But I will tell you the most exciting part of at least like the foundations and the scaffolding to this work is that the very first time that we as an organization launched an initiative about representation, the two co-chairs for that initiative were two Black women alongside me. And I remember sitting across the table and I felt like such a nerd because, you know, my CEO sit next to me and I'm like about to go in this like very nervous pitch. And I was like, I'm about to break script just to say, it's an honor to see the two of you across the table. Like, it just was that moment of like, I have never in my years of pitching and doing deals with companies and foundations thought about raising millions of dollars and having the two women across the table be two Black women. And so
I just have to snap to that, right? That right there was a pure Black woman magic moment. And so I love that you took that moment to lean in, to acknowledge it, to celebrate it, to relish in it, right? Because, you know, really what you've described today, what you're doing and what you're helping to lead is really groundbreaking, not just for Donor's Choose, but for the field of philanthropy, right? Mm-hmm. For the field of philanthropy. And so, you know, there's all these things that are percolating for me as I'm having this conversation. So we will definitely have a follow-up conversation. Yeah. We'll definitely have you back to continue to understand your impact and the ways that we can mobilize, right? The Be Well, Beautiful Woman community and anyone, right, that tunes in. So, You know, earlier we talked about the fact that, you know, I gave this huge gift and finally saw myself and started coining myself as a philanthropist to an organization that has a rich history within my community called the Black Arts and Cultural Center. And they had this capital campaign and I gave, it was, they were raising like $150,000, which as we know is not a lot of money, but it is, right?
Listen.
And so I gave a third towards that campaign, even more than our local foundations, right? And we have a lot of billionaires right here in my
community.
Listen. And so, but what struck me about that is the thing that happens time and time again, related to Black-led organizations or organizations that are designed to support Black and Brown people that are being shortchanged in terms of investment, in terms of capacity building. And, you know, when I started my consulting practice 15 years ago, that was one of the things that I said, that capacity building should not be for only people who can afford it. And if you want to be able to entrust your resources into an organization and you know that there's gaps in terms of their efficacy to run their organizations, then give them some money to address it, right? Like address the issue at its core. So I said all that to say, sis, you know, why is it important for us to, again, align with the things that we care about the most? And as people of color, particularly to be looking for those opportunities to fulfill the gaps that oftentimes exist for us to be able to have the resources that we need to be able to have the impact that we know only we can have. And I say only we, because a lot of times people try to replicate, you know, and steal from Black-led organizations and take strategies. When I ran Freedom Schools, people would say, oh, well, how do I do Harambe? I'm like, you can take Harambe if you want. Harambe is not Freedom Schools. And you won't even be able to deliver Harambe the way we do, because this is sacred. This is spiritual. This is ancestral. And so I know that we are speaking the same language about these huge deficits that exist even today. And many philanthropists know, I've had conversations with some of them that know that they are investing inadequately, inequitably for what we need to be able to do the work that only we uniquely can do. Listen, sis.
Yes. I know it's a podcast, but I just want the listeners to, I wish my silence would show my face of like, yes, 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 to all of that. And I will just add, there is so much richness to this work. And there is so much, there's so much to how nuanced the story and the impact can be. And, you know, I think about in my own family, my nuclear family. So my husband and I are both HBCU graduates. He went to Howard. So, you know, he's probably walking around like, ain't you? He can hear me.
Yes, I love it.
and I went to Spelman and we talked about even the diversity of the HBCU experience is like one really, really rich way to think about how we give. What does it mean to show up for homecoming and give back there, right? On Donors Choose, we now collect as a part of the ICME initiative where a teacher went to undergrad. We asked teachers to share with us, tell us about your alma mater. And in turn, that means that today, if you wanted to come support On Donors Choose Spelman graduates, we could help you ensure that you could support HBCU graduates. So that is connected to what you're asking, because part of, I think, what makes this work so rich and so nuanced and so multifaceted is we as a people are, right? Like there's so much in how we address equity that allows for us to, I think, show up in the most authentic way and to give to the causes that we care most about. And when, you know, I think in tying it back to Donors Choose, it makes it so incredible on the equity front for donors of color, for Black women in philanthropy, for Black philanthropists is, you might come to Donors Choose and say, I'm really excited to find a Black teacher to support, or I'm in Atlanta, a Black teacher in Atlanta. That's amazing. But you know what else you could do? You might want to find a Black teacher teaching in schools where students have special needs, because that's unique to my family. I've got, you know, autism in my family. So when I think about just generally this idea of we show up in the world, this I do through the lens of a Black woman and also a Black mom and also a Black mom of a kid with special needs. And so on Donors Choose, we're the place where literally in our name, donors choose, right? And so when you come to our site, we're giving you the chance to be an everyday philanthropist, but also to advance equity in ways that you might not imagine.
Yeah.
And when I talked about the sum total of our data, every classroom project funded on our site, so every book that gets supported, every, I keep saying butterfly cocoons. I feel like I'm like out of touch with what kids are doing nowadays in high school. I don't know, maybe it's like dissection kids. I don't know. But like every single one actually gives us a chance to amass more data. And as you know, from that Male Teacher of Color Initiative and from ICME, the sum total of more data is more listening and learning to communities that are underrepresented in the field. So by coming to our site and supporting a cheerleading classroom project on donors choose, congratulations, you're actually advancing equity on our site, because now we have more data around what we're seeing happen across the country with hundreds of thousands of teachers. And we pour that right back into the programming that we do.
Yeah, I love that you connected that that gift has a ripple effect, right? Yes. It's not just a gift with you all. It's a gift that helps to help you all understand what are the most needs so that you can direct the funds to those needs accordingly. So just a couple more things before we wrap up. I'm always like, oh, we're like at the end already, but we're going to have you back. Like we've already established.
I accept.
Yes. So what I want to explore briefly now is that, you know, we've talked about your passion around fighting for equity for Black and Brown people. And you know, how Donors Choose has really done that. And what I'm curious about is that because women, right, are our jam at Be Well, Beautiful Woman, how do you use an intersectional lens and your work outside of what you've already shared with us, centering the unique challenges of women and girls?
Yes. Well, I have a daughter, so I should mention that. So this work is near and dear to my heart. My baby girl is 2 years old. She's a beautiful young Black child. So this work is personal to me just as much as this is my professional work. But, you know, I studied critical race theory in law school, and intersectionality is like so core. It's a core tenet, right, of the work with Kimberly Crenshaw. And so part of how we think about and focus on women and girls is also just related to big picture, our approach to advancing equity, because it is a farce. And I think I mentioned this before, but it's a farce to think that we can separate out different parts of ourselves, right? I cannot today divorce my motherhood any more than for my womanhood or for my Blackness, any more than a young Black girl sitting in a public school today in Atlanta can separate out her experience of being a girl from her experience of being a student of color, right? And we realize at Donors Choose that this plays out in real ways. And our team at Donors Choose continues to not only think about the internal work and the internal data that we collect as an organization, but we have our eye on the field, like what's happening with respect to the research in K-12 education as it relates to policies, as it relates to what's happening in schools. And one thing that like caught our eye, for example, is that we were just digging into it nationally, how Black girls are still experiencing disproportionate discipline rates, right? And consequences starting in preschool, right? And so we are thinking about this by tying together what's happening in the field with what's happening on our site, because we are at our scale at this point, we're a real match to what's happening. So we can begin to see what's happening across our platform, marry it with what's happening externally in the field, and begin to say, we need initiative on this. Or, what do we know about discipline rates? Or, let's talk about why these stats are coming out post-pandemic about male teachers of color or Black teachers in the profession leaving more quickly. Mm-hmm. And I just want to flag one thing that is correlated to what you're sharing about sort of the marriage of all things equity, internal and external. When we launched that Male Teacher of Color Initiative, and we surveyed thousands of teachers, we had to survey both male teachers of color and then all sorts of other teacher demographics, so white teachers, women educators, et cetera, because we needed to compare male teachers of color to those other groups. Mm-hmm. And one of the findings that we saw that really caught my eye and had me sort of dig into other pieces of our work was that the group of educators that shared that they were the most burnt out during the pandemic, we thought it was going to be Black men in the profession. Like we just knew that was going to be our finding because we're on the heels of George Floyd. I'm talking to my own household every night at dinner and like, are you safe? How are you feeling? But it was actually Black women educators who said we're the most burned out. And that opened up the door for us because we said, oh my goodness, we went into this thinking that we were going to sort of take the lens of like, we're just here to find out about male teachers of color. But in turn, we realized that once again, we are taking the approach of realizing that in that instance, the most marginalized we were talking about was male teachers of color. But when we step back in lots of other aspects of what happens in the field, we know that the most marginalized, the most affected are often Black women and sometimes queer mm-hmm. Black women. Yeah. And so it just allowed us to say, every time we run these initiatives, we really have to think about when we center the most marginalized, it helps everyone. And so that actually has become, that's a roundabout way of getting to part of our core. We have like sort of themes on our team around how we think about equity. And we talk about, we are race explicit, but not race exclusive, because that's impossible. Yes. And also it's really important for us to realize that when you center the most marginalized in any environment, you are most, and create your programs for that group, then in turn, what's going to happen is greater ripple effects for everyone. So that was a roundabout way of getting to, we center the most marginalized. We always center race. And I know as a Black woman with in all sorts of aspects of my life, how important it is for us to put us first.
Yeah. You, this is so powerful what you're saying, because of course, what we hear is that Black boys, Black boys, Black boys, and yes, and Black girls, Black girls, Black girls, right? Black men, Black men, Black men, and Black women, Black women, Black women. And so, you know, even when we typically talk about police brutality, we leave so many Black women off that roster that have also died at the hands of law enforcement. And so, you know, what you're offering for us today is to think about, like, no matter what system that we're talking about, really, more than likely Black women are probably at the center of it, are at the center of being oppressed within the context of that system, whether we're talking philanthropy or education or law enforcement. And so thank you for giving us that gift. And thank you for to looking hard at your data to make sense of it, not just for the people that you initially set out, right, to understand, but to look at the data close enough to say, okay, what are the other parts that we now understand, and what can we do about it? And I think that is the ongoing work of equity, knowing that you're approaching it with some level of understanding, some level of celebration for what it is that you've done, but this recognition that there's always more for us to do. So this leads me to my last question. This is a good segue when we're talking about Black women and burnout, right? We would be remiss if we were in this space of Be Well, Beautiful Woman and not talking about wellness. So I would love for you to talk with the audience about, you know, how do you embody well-being in your life, right? I imagine that in your role in general, it's rigorous. And then when we think about all the other identities, like you said, and that you can't separate, you know, it's that well-being to prevent burnout, right, proactively is so important. And before you answer that, something that I thought about and that I don't want to miss is that, you know, I'm the board chair of YWCA Kalamazoo, and we oftentimes say from an intersectional perspective, you can't eliminate racism without empowering women. Right. And really, you can't empower women without eliminating racism. Yes. And so it's so critical for us to always examine not just that one identity, but the multitude of identities that feeds, right? And that actually has, you know, your lived experience stacked upon itself, right? Because we know that a woman has things. We know a Black woman has even more. And we know a gay Black woman has even more to contend with. And so thank you again for like offering that and to for helping us to appreciate the ways in which donors choose is using that lens in the fabric of your work. I'm deeply inspired by this and I can't wait to dive in more. So now back to that question of well-being, how do you embody it? So that you can prevent burnout and to live at your highest, right? Because it's not just about, you know, getting by. Hopefully it's about like saying yes in all the ways to life.
Yes. Okay. I'll start with work and then I'll just like fade it into my life, because I think part of equity work, DEI work is so deeply personal, where you have to be really intentional, as I do, about how you can both live a joyful life and show up at work and talk about, you know, racial disparities in school discipline while my son's upstairs, they're off school, hearing his voice, right? It's like, it's just so connected and it's always on. And so one thing that I often tell my team, and I got this from a fellow Black woman at my organization, Danon, who often says like rest and resilience is like hand in hand, right? And so this mm-hmm. idea is one that I've taken into the way that I even run my own team within Donor's Choose, which is I'm probably annoying to my team where I'm like, I don't think you've taken your vacation days. Why haven't you taken, you know, like, wait a minute, like step away. What are you doing today? Like get outside. And so this idea of like, for me, I've been trying to capture not only for my team, but for myself, these real opportunities where like in the moment, I can just take a step back. Mm-hmm. And this recently happened. I can't even talk about it without like getting too emotional, but with respect to what continues to happen in the news with police brutality and Black men dying in the street. I remember telling a colleague who wanted my support on something, I can't do it. Like just today, I cannot come up with a statement. I cannot support you. I just can't do it. And it was tough to do as a DEI leader because I was like, well, that's kind of my job, right? Then I was like, but not today. This right here hit too hard and I need tomorrow, you know, tomorrow. And so there's something about saying no and letting that be a full sentence. That's become my new mantra in my work. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll just end with the personal, which is, you know, I do have a beautiful young family. Mm-hmm. The listeners might hear my son living his best life on his iPad right outside the door. But, you know, my husband is an incredible partner in that we believe, and we read together, E. Brodsky's book. It's on the, like, it's called Fair Play, but it's on like the gender division of labor. And we believe in like holding a feminist mindset in our work in that, both of us run this household. Like we are co-CEOs. This is a well-run organization that we must run well in order for us to live both full lives. And something that E. Brodsky talks a lot about is like, when you get to that place of like truly living and being intentional, even on the home front and how you do your work, you enter what's called the like unicorn space where you can begin to be your more creative. And for me, I grew up cheerleading. I cheered professionally. I'm like a yogi. So for me, that looks like when I'm not at my desk and I'm not changing pull-ups and diapers, I'm on the yoga mat or I'm on a treadmill or I'm taking deep breaths and meditation from Black women that I like to follow who do the same. And so, I guess all that is to say, for me, wellness looks like truly, I never want to divorce my work from my personal life. I chose work that is actually important to my personal life. And I just know how to say no.
Come on.
And I know how to, when I'm not well, step away till I am. And so having had two children and been through lots there, that's probably been the biggest life lesson from 2020 on, which is if you're not well, then physical and mental weakness is going to prevent the accomplishment of everything else that you're going to try to get done. So yeah.
you gave us so much life with that answer. Like you know, from finding your passion, right? Because when we're doing our passion work, it doesn't really, it's not separate. It is a part of, the air we breathe, right? And I love how you've offered us to think about the interruption, right? The ways in which we think we should be versus the way in which we need to honor thyself. And like what you said is so powerful that I am supposed to, but nah, I can't today. Exactly. And that is a sign of the power that you have harnessed within yourself to interrupt some of the ways that we're harming ourselves, yeah. And really owning that. But you also talked about it as a leader and being at the forefront of it for your team. And so, you know, when we're talking about wellness, when we're talking about burnout, what you've helped us to think about is what is the system's role, the leader's role in cultivating it, but what is also my individual role, right? In cultivating it both within the workplace and within my family life, right? And also interrupting like gender roles, right? In the household, right? And so like you just
fully gave interrupted. So yes.
Much. And you gave us so much, sister, and everything that you said, right, about, and I like that you're offering us to think about, it's very individualized, right, but you're also acknowledging that movement, that getting into breath, that being still in however ways that we cultivate it is the baseline for you, right, so that you can be well, and you know you're speaking my language, because that is, you know, those are the things that exist in my life, right, that's why for me first, I have indulged in tons of wellness, from yoga to trauma to breath work to Reiki, but then for the light that I'm supposed to share with others, right, me first, then others, So thank you for this. This interview has given me life. I always enjoy having these conversations. And there are a lot of things that we touched on that I didn't even anticipate. That's the beautiful thing about being on the journey. And I know for certain people are going to want to stay in touch with not just you, of course, but also discover more about Donors Choose and your impact and the great work that you're doing. So talk to us about how we can stay connected to you.
Yes. Okay. So if you want to stay a part of the Donors Choose community, come join us. We're at Donors Choose across all the platforms. So on Facebook, on LinkedIn, if you're on LinkedIn. So on Instagram, it's at Donors Choose, one word. And then on LinkedIn, although I go by Steen, my name is Christina Joy Lyle. So come find me. I like to chat a lot more about the initiatives that we do. And that's Christina with the K and Joy with an E. And then on Instagram, you'll get a chance to see some of my muses, which are my two kids, but also the work that I do. And that's at underscore Steen Lyles.
Wonderful.
Thank you. You're a light. Now I'm stealing the mic for a second to say, every time I get in these conversations, I think about my main muse being my grandmother, who I want to make proud by like truly resting, truly living into all the things that she didn't get a chance to do. And when I think about this platform, what you have created here is really powerful. So I just want to say thank you. This has not even felt, this is through work, but it hasn't felt like work. I caught myself getting choked up a couple of times. I was like, you know, Steen, chill out. So just thank you. And I really cannot wait for us to find more ways to collaborate, because I think what you've created in the philanthropic space, in this like atmosphere, in your wellness journey, it's really an inspiration. And similar when I sat across from Carol and Desiree and was like, I'm honored to be here. I feel a little bit like I'm like stepping out of my imposter shell. Like, I'm honored to be here with you. So Thank you. And I cannot wait for our next conversation, even if it's over a glass of wine and we're in person. So there's
Gosh, listen, I will get on a flight. Like I say, don't. I'm not somebody who says it. I will get on a plane and come to you.
We're like, we accept.
Listen. And I love Atlanta so much. And Steen, like I'm deeply grateful. I'm deeply grateful. And you talked about holding back your tears. I had a moment where I just literally said that to myself, Damara, just keep it together. Right. And not because it's about, we don't want to expose that part, right. We want to just keep it together long enough to be able to give out the messages that we're called to do. But I am truly honored. I had no idea, that this would be such a beautiful interview. Of course I said yes, cause I knew it would be great, but I had no idea that it would be so beautiful. And I'm grateful that I got to know you, that Donors Choose has you to do the work, and that we, meaning Be Well Beautiful Woman and the world, gets to learn from you, because I'm telling you, there's a lot that we can learn from you and your practices. So the extent to which you all have helped to influence, you know, the cultural context of philanthropy, I know that there's more coming in that regard. So y'all heard it here at Be Well Beautiful Woman. Please make sure that you connect with this queen, Christina Steen Lyle. She already told you all the ways that you can stay in touch with her, see her family in action, get to know her better, and to get to know the rich work of Donors Choose and how they are interrupting the education space in a multitude of ways, along with philanthropy and all the intersectional ways that we talked about. And if you haven't already, check out Be Well Beautiful Woman at you can email us at info@bewellbeautifulwoman.com. Check us out on the web at Be Well Beautiful Woman. That's B-E, Be Well Beautiful Woman. And then on Instagram at the letter Be Well Beautiful. Until next time, beauties, ashe. Thank you, Steen.
Thank you.